And we are indeed honored to introduce our guest today, the Reverend Dr. William Augustus Jones, Jr. And there's a lot of wonderful things to say about him. I got acquainted with Dr. Jones yesterday evening and immediately found that we had many things in common. He is a native of Lexington, Kentucky, and an alumnus of the University of Kentucky. Revival may break out any moment. He was born here in Louisville, however. But his parents quickly repented and moved to Lexington, where his grandfather was pastor of the Green Street Baptist Church here in Louisville. His father pastored the historic Pleasant Green Baptist Church in Lexington. Dr. Jones is not only a graduate of the University of Kentucky, but also the Crozer Theological Seminary. He holds his doctorate from Colgate Rochester Divinity School. He's studied many other places, including the University of Lagos and the University of Ghana. A staunch Christian activist, he has for many years been a leader in the struggle for human rights and economic justice. His first pastorate was at the First Baptist Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where he served for 3 years, beginning in July 1959. But since September of 1962, he's been pastor of the Great Bethany Baptist Church in New York, and just this Sunday celebrated his 35th anniversary as pastor of that congregation of 5,000. He has a full-time staff of 27 persons committed to the principle that the church should be free from all outside encumbrances. Bethany has never sought nor accepted funds from any outside sources. He's a former president of the Progressive National Baptist Convention, a founder of the National Black Pastors Conference. He has received the New York Urban League's prestigious Frederick Douglass Award, commissioned a Kentucky colonel in 1976. He is listed in Who's Who in America. He has been called by the New York Daily News the Dean of New York's Great Preachers. In addition to his earned doctorate, he holds many honorary doctorates, including one from Benedict College, Simmons University, Shaw University, Campbell University. In May 1993, his alma mater, the University of Kentucky, conferred a Doctor of Humanities degree on him. In December of 1996, he was awarded the Doctor of Literature degree by the Evangelical Reformed School of Theology in Toledo, Ohio. He has preached on every continent in the world. He served as visiting professor at Colgate Rochester Divinity School, Wesley Theological Seminary, Princeton Theological Seminary, Union Theological Seminary, and the United Theological Seminary. He has many published works, including The Black Church Looks at the Bicentennial, God in the Ghetto, Responsible Preaching, and The African American Church, Past, Present, and Future. But the greatest thing to say is he is a child of God and a preacher of the Word. And we welcome Dr. Jones to this pulpit to bring the E.Y. Mullins lectures on preaching after Dr. Dan Hatfield comes and shares a time of intercessory prayer with us.
Other leaders in this worship experience, and all of you, my comrades in the invincible army of faith, how delighted I am to come once again to this campus. It was my happy experience quite a number of years ago to come here as the speaker for what was known as the Kimbrough Lectures. And now, out of your graciousness, I'm permitted to come again. I'm especially appreciative of this invitation because the man in whose honor these lectures are held, the late E.Y. Mullins, was a significant force in my own experience nearly 40 years ago when I was a student at Crozer Theological Seminary. Crozer at the time was the citadel of Protestant liberalism in this country. And an old preacher directed me to Dr. Mullen's book, now a classic, The Christian Religion in Its Doctrinal Expression. And it helped me over many a hump. Now, I stand here with mixed emotions. You know what mixed emotions are, do you not? An old lady in Richmond, Virginia walked up to me once after I had preached in that church, and I said to her, "How are you today, my dear?" She had to be at least 85 years of age, and she looked at me and she said, "Well, boy, it's like this. I'm somewhere between thank you, Jesus, and Lord have mercy." Now, I'll tell you why that's my state of being presently. I got a call shortly before coming to this chapel from my youngest daughter, who is a New York lawyer. And she told me that she was getting ready to go to Beth Israel Hospital to give birth to her firstborn. So I'm somewhere between thank you, Jesus, and Lord have mercy. Now, Dr. York has already explained to me the constraints of time that characterize this situation. You know, I come out of a tradition that says you finish when you get through. But I assure you that I will not take too long. The years have taught wisdom, as they should. I had a friend, an Anglican bishop, Colin Winter, who was Bishop of Namibia in exile, and some years ago I sat with him at dinner in his home at Sutton Courtenay, just outside of Oxford. And he told me about a London preacher who had a real problem. Whenever that preacher preached, everybody fell asleep. The choir behind him, the deacons before him, the ushers on their post. Word had it that even his wife slept whenever he preached. And it began to bother him, but he heard of a preacher in one of the shires outside of London whose reputation was the exact opposite. Whenever that preacher preached, everybody remained awake and alert. So he went out to see him, found him at home, and he got to the point at once. He said, "How do you do it?" "How do I do what? How do you keep them awake? Whenever I preach, everybody sleeps." He said, "Oh, it's not difficult at all." Said, "I do two or three things." Said, "First thing I do is get me a good introduction, and then I get a good conclusion. And then I do a third thing. I put the two as close together as I possibly can." And that's what I want to do today. Proceeding from the basic presupposition that it is our task to speak to the totality of the human situation, and also remembering what the late Emil Brunner once said in my hearing, the greatest sin of the church is that she withholds the gospel from herself. I want today to talk about death in the pot. And I lift up verse 40 in chapter 4 of the book of 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 4, the 40th verse. Here's what it says. "So they poured out for the men to eat. And it came to pass, as they were eating of the pottage, that they cried out and said, O thou man of God, there is death in the pot. And they could not eat thereof. A certain prophet's days are drawing to a close. It will not be long before he makes exit from earth to eternity. Elijah is his name. Among the greatest of the prophets, he's a Tishbite out of Gilead, having suddenly appeared on the scene during the reign of Ahab in the 9th century BC. His major work is now behind him. He has denounced the idolatry and wickedness of Ahab and his wife Jezebel. He has discredited the 400 prophets of Baal at Carmel. His 40 days of sustenance when God gave him water from a brook and sent ravens to feed him now belong to history. The end of his earthly pilgrimage is not far off. It won't be long now before God summons him to report to a spot on the east of Jordan, where in the presence of a young prophet named Elisha, God will do a wondrous thing. The incessant movement of the days ushers in that eventful day. At the appointed time, Elijah and Elisha stood by Jordan, while 50 men of the sons of the prophets stood and viewed from afar. Elijah took his mantle, wrapped it together, smote the waters, and he and the young prophet went over on dry ground. Elijah then said to young Elisha, ask what I shall do for you before I'm taken from you. Elisha neither stammered nor stuttered. Said he, I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. Well, replied Elijah, you ask a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I'm taken from you, you shall receive it. If, as I rise, your focus remains clear, you've got it. And then it happened. Strange and peculiar activity initiated from beyond the skies. A divinely inaugurated spectacle. A chariot of fire drawn by horses of fire separated the two men, and young Elisha saw old man Elijah go up by a whirlwind into heaven. He had the double portion. He had Elijah's mantle. And with that mantle, he smote the waters, went over Jordan, and when the sons of the prophets beheld him, they declared, the spirit of Elijah doth rest on Elisha. God worked mightily through the young man. Miracles happened by virtue of his intercession. It was a Shunammite woman who placed upon him the loftiest and most enduring designation that can be bestowed on any mortal. She called him, Thou Man of God. Elijah carried forth the work of his mentor. Elisha, rather, carried forth the work of his mentor, Elijah. He continued that school of learning whose student body was composed exclusively of the sons of the prophet. Things were going the young man's way. He, upon whose nod the universe depends, was smiling on Elisha. But crisis is ineluctable. Life, said the late Samuel Miller, Dean of Harvard Chapel, is not an untroubled serenity. There came a day when, upon departing Shunem, he came again to a place called Gilgal. Things were not well at all in Gilgal. The times were hard, the days were difficult. The people were in great pain. There was a famine in the land. Elisha sat down with the sons of the prophets before him. Sensing their hunger, he instructed his servant, "Put on the large pot and boil stew for these sons of the prophet." One of them went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it a lapful of wild gourds. He came and sliced them into the pot of stew, not really knowing what they were. And then when it was done, they poured it out for the men to eat. And as they were eating the stew, they cried out in unison and in utter agony, "O man of God, there is death in the pot." The young man who gathered the gourds thought he had gathered a gourd called Cucumis profitarum, which was common out in the hill country and good for eating when sliced and boiled as a vegetable. But not knowing, he brought back Colocynthus, a poisonous cucumber similar in appearance to the edible plant. Deceived by an appearance, he made a tragic error that resulted in death in the pot. I think I'll tell you that I waited for some 30 years to talk about this passage. It charmed and fascinated and intrigued my homiletical instincts time and time again. I wanted badly to embrace it, examine it, exegete it, even eisegete it, and then exclaim the fruit of my labor. But it would come only within teasing distance. I would reach for it, only to have it elude my grasp. It played an awful game of hide and seek. And that's how it is with some of these strange, bizarre, and yet euphonious passages in the Blessed Book. But one day, in reaching for it, it grabbed me and would not let go. It took 30 years of longing, hoping, yearning, pleading, panting, and waiting. I'm certain that it was not ready for me because I wasn't ready for it. Oh, man of God, there is death in the pot. A plain pot on a simple stove above an ordinary flame in an humble kitchen, but that plain pot has been visited by an unwelcome reality. There's been an intrusion of sorts, an invasion, if you please, to the ordinarily safe and wholesome confines of a pot has come the arch enemy of the ages. That painful visitor ushered into being by sin has come uninvited to a pot from whence sons of the prophets shall eat. In a time already made terrible by famine in the land, death sneaks in by way of a pot of stew. Death, the grim reaper, the unwelcome guest, death, the last enemy, the pale horse's rider. Death is in the pot, death. Cemetery planner and tombstone builder. Death, the noun for dead, which has been called the most vulgar of the four-letter words. Death is in the pot. The pot, instrument of life-supporting substance. The pot, vessel and container of that which spells subsistence. Death in the pot? Yes, that's what they declared. O thou man of God, there is death in the pot. Given the advantage of a backward look and an overview, one cannot help but make an assessment of the contemporary predicament. However, there is one factor that makes contemporary analysis difficult. Let me explain. Like Gilgal, there's a famine in the land today, and there is death in the pot today. The problem is this: it's difficult to tell which produced which. Is death in the pot the cause of famine in the land? Or is death in the pot because of famine in the land? Or are they twin horses that together make up a team that spells havoc and hell? When I look at the landscape, I see a scene of famine and drought. I see degenerate democracy, moral bankruptcy, synthetic values, and ethical insanity. I see uncaring politics and non-prophetic religion. There's a famine in the land. I see socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor, resulting in longer bread lines, more soup kitchens, and fewer food stamps. There's a famine in the land. I see massive unemployment, swelling racial inequity, and more homelessness than during the Great Depression. There's a famine in the land. I see teeming multitudes of dropouts, flunkouts, and pushouts walking aimlessly with nothing to do because it appears that there's no place to be somebody and therefore nowhere to go. I see the death of dignity brought on by hope's long holiday. There's a famine in the land. In this land where the melting pot metaphor never blossomed into reality, there's a famine in the land that's either the cause of or because of death in the pot. The prophet of the Lord sends souls out to gather herbs for the hungry and the famished, and unknowing souls return with poisonous gourds for the simmering pot. What an assortment of wild, poisonous herbs fills this pot. And those who insist on eating surely die because there is death in the pot. But the sons of the prophets, given to authentic spirituality, taste and then declare, O man of God, there is death in the pot. Certain novices, the spiritually uninitiated, those who've had no real encounter with the eternal, have brought the wrong herbs to the pot of life. The unregenerate, those who have a form of godliness but deny the power thereof. Those who are wise in their own eyes and who humble not themselves before the Lord, they've put poisonous herbs in the pot. And they are operating all over this famine-stricken land, from the White House to the courthouse to the schoolhouse and even to the church house. Corruption is commonplace. Deceit, deception, and disinformation are operative at the highest levels of government. Star Wars is more important than planetary peace. There's gun running and arms sales by government that violates its own laws. We've seen heartless, senseless presidents invade tiny Grenada, bomb little Libya, attack Panama and destroy Iraq, and then boast of American strength and resolve. Add to this ugly scenario apathy on the part of most of the citizenry, silent pulpits, spineless preachers, and comfortable pews. Tis no wonder there's death in the pot. When you have pulpits occupied by people who prefer lowering their voices in order to raise their budgets, you've got death in the pot. I challenge you today to examine the deadly, dreadful contents of this seething pot. Every imaginable sin and evil is in it for human consumption. Liquor, drugs, illicit sex, sexual perversion, pornography, gambling, whether legal or illegal, common law marriage, babies having babies, women who want children without marriage, strange diseases that plague the body politic, the attempt by some to make homosexuality an authentic third sex, gay clergy, gay fellowships, gay churches, crimes of every conceivable description, sloppy sin and sophisticated sin. The unknowing have brought to the pot from the fields of sin all kinds of poisonous, death-dealing gourds. And the results are so tragic that the dead are dancing with the dead, and the dead are burying the dead. How bitter the taste of this simmering stew, how offensive its odor, how fatal the consequences. In the midst of so much misery, caused by so much madness, one is tempted to throw in the towel and say, what's the use? Why go on? But always, so God has fixed it. There is a remnant, a faithful few who believe that life is larger than death and that hope can cope with despair. They may not clearly understand what's happening, but they can tell when things are out of joint. They know evil when they see it. They sense destruction when it is imminent. And they know how to tell Elisha, oh man of God, there is death in the pot. Perhaps the great difficulty today is for the faithful to be able to find some Elisha. That's the problem, locating Elisha. For Elishas are indeed a rare breed. You don't find them on every corner. Elishas don't run with the common herd. Elishas don't play patsy with politicians. Elishas don't beg the government for handouts. Elishas don't capitulate to culture. Elishas don't dilute and pervert the biblical revelation. Elishas do not take their cues from the pews. Elishas are always waiting for the movement of the God of the whirlwind. Elishas are not astonished by fiery chariots and horses of fire. Elishas believe that God can part Jordan River, so they live always in the realm of expectancy. Elishas are always looking for mystery to break in on their pilgrimage. In a word, Elishas obey God rather than man. And when the pot is poisoned, you'd better know some Elisha to whom you can declare, O man of God, there is death in the pot. That's what these sensitive spiritual sons of the prophets told Elisha. What will Elijah's successor do? He must do something, and he must do it quickly. Get some meal, says Elisha. They got some meal. He puts meal in the pot, that same pot where death is at work. And then he says, serve it to the people to eat. They serve from the pot, and everybody begins to eat. And the closing word is this: there was no harm in the pot. My, what an interesting progression. What a significant succession of stages. First, famine in the land, then death in the pot, and then meal in the pot, and then no harm in the pot. It was the divinely ordained meal that made the difference. You see, that meal represented life and grace and goodness. The meal represented wholeness, completeness, and integrity. The only antidote for death is life. Life has to get in the pot with death. And death cannot deal with authentic life. Death always has to yield to life. That's really what the incarnation was all about. Life getting in the pot with death. In Adam all sin, but in Christ all are made alive. God sent his son to get in the pot with death. And because he was life with a capital L, death couldn't keep him. It was impossible for death to hold him. And I know because I have conversed with death. I once asked death, who are you? Are you person or thing? Where did you come from? Who do you work for? Death did not answer. And then I asked him, death, have you ever erred? And he answered, once, only once. I got jammed one Friday. Jammed by the politics of Rome and the religion of Jerusalem. They forced my hand and made me climb a hill where I had no business. There was a middleman on a cross up there, and he didn't deserve my embrace. And I was forced to grab him, and I held on to him until early Sunday morning. And then a power greater than me broke my embrace. I had to let him go, and I was glad to let him go. Early that Sunday morning, right early, as my fathers would say, early, while the dew was still on the roses, and early, amid the golden splendor of a Sunday sunrise, death let him go, and the grave lost its victory. I tell you, death cannot handle authentic life. Evil can't destroy goodness, and that's why we are admonished, be not overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I tell you, the meal represented life and grace and goodness. Only grace can make for authentic life. Only grace can make you fully alive. I don't know what evil you may be wrestling with presently, but I do know you'd better let him in your pot. He can fix it, he can cleanse it, he can tame the terrible, he can right wrongs, he can repair your brokenness, he can heal your hurt. He'll put a new song in your mouth. He'll fix you for your journey, and I'll tell you how he does it. He'll either fix the pot for you or fix you for the pot. He fixed Moses for Pharaoh, and he fixed the Red Sea for Moses. He fixed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego for the fiery furnace, and got in the furnace and walked with them. He fixed the lions for dauntless Daniel, so that a den of lions became Daniel's den. He fixed Paul and Silas for jail, and then fixed the jail for them. He fixed John for Patmos, so much so that John was in the Spirit on the Lord's day and declared, "I saw the Son of God walking in the New Jerusalem among the golden candlesticks." I tell you, he either fixes the pot for you or you for the pot. But always the outcome is the same. There's no harm in the pot. Before he fixes it, you can start singing, "The Lord is my light and my salvation, whom shall I fear?" While he's fixing it, you can declare, "Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come." And after he fixes it, you can declare, "From sinking sand, he lifted me." No harm in the pot. Skeptics may scorn, critics may convene, devils may disturb, but there's no harm in the pot. So then, lift the trumpet, raise the flag, ring the bell, shout the victory. No harm, no harm, no harm. All is well. Mind at ease, soul satisfied. There's no harm in the pot.